Ah, son!
Roland Martin here, TV show host and bass tournament winner. You know, when I travel, I'm constantly asked about my biggest fish I've ever caught. Well, my biggest fish was an 875-pound bluefin tuna caught with none other than Angelo Viola in Nova Scotia just a couple years ago.
You got him, buddy!
Now, you listen to Angelo on the Outdoor Journal radio show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. He'll put you on where to go and how to catch your biggest fish ever.
Thank you, Roland. Welcome back to the program, Outdoor Journal on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm Angelo Viola. He is Stephen Labadie, engineer extraordinaire, and Derek Brandeo at the controls, keeping us off the rocks and on the straight and narrow today on the phone with us. It's going to be a fascinating gentleman. Let me just set it up first. For many years, in fact, over the last month, all we've been reading is about the end of the world. Apparently, it's coming in 2050, from what I understand. I don't make light of it. I'm just saying it's curious they actually have a year now pegged out for it.
Yeah, like in 2012.
That's right. But for many years, scientists have been warning about the dangers of high level of greenhouse gases that are released into the atmosphere every day. And you know, there's all kinds of people coming up with what they think are solutions, including our very own leader of this country, who figures a few more tax dollars wouldn't hurt that situation at all with the carbon tax. Well, we recently found out about a very interesting company in Squamish, British Columbia, which is in the business of collecting carbon dioxide and processing it, mechanically removing it from the atmosphere. And it's a fascinating story, a fascinating company. And to talk to us more about that is Dr. Michael Oppenheimer, Department of Geosciences at the Princeton University in New Jersey, New Jersey. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm glad to be here today.
Good, good. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, this company out in Squamish is claiming that they are collecting and processing carbon dioxide. Now, they're just one of many companies that are doing their part to try and help reduce greenhouse gases. Don't know to what extent they're going to succeed, but it's always good that people are at least trying. So we're all ears when it comes to that stuff. Now, what are you guys doing in terms of the research on greenhouse gases?
Well, we do. First of all, there are thousands of scientists doing research on greenhouse gases, and it runs all the way from where they come from, how to get rid of them, like the Squamish effort, all the way to what the impacts of the greenhouse gases are in terms of warming Earth and changing the climate, and then what those climate changes are going to do to you, me, and everybody else. By the way, yeah, the world is not going to end in 2050. That's a vast exaggeration. What will happen is it will gradually become a meaner, nastier, and more costly place to live, and some people will not make it, basically. This is not a pretty situation we're headed into.
I did the math. I'll be 56.
Yeah, I won't be here. I won't be here, so I won't have to worry about it. That's a terrible attitude to take. All right, so listen, it sounds like a pretty straightforward fix to me because, and here's what I mean by this, we've isolated the problem. We've isolated, we know what the cause is. We know what's happening. We know what it's doing to the environment. We know what it's doing to the planet. It's pretty straightforward. Let's just fix it. But that's not the case, obviously.
The problem. If only it were that simple. There are a couple of obstacles. For instance, although it would be a better planet in the long term, and although we might actually save money in the long term, most people, most political systems don't think about the long term. They think about tomorrow, next year, maybe the year after. Politicians think on, well, when's the next election so I can get reelected and not do anything too dramatic. And so, yes, there are costs in the short term. That's number one. Manageable, but they're there. More important, there are costs to particular industries, particularly the industries like the oil and the coal industry, which dig up fossil fuels, which we burn, and which cause the problem in the first place. And those people are powerful, and they don't like this kind of change. So between the natural kind of inertia and indifference that many people feel about the long term, and the fact that there are powerful political opponents, we're in a situation where it's very difficult to get anything done.
And unfortunately, that's going to be a wheel that we can't turn because it is. I mean, how do you turn the biggest industry on the planet, right? And that is the harvesting of fossil fuels and turning it into whatever it is we need to be motorized. But I'm interested in the Squamish thing and any other group that's sort of looking outside of the box on the solution, because I guess, you know, if I'm in the hunt for a new business and I know that we have an excess amount of carbon dioxide out there, wouldn't I be smart to come up with a way of trying to use that and reclaim that and do something else with it and maybe even make a buck on it?
Sure. Let me put some context on it first. The major way to get rid of the problem is to reduce and eventually eliminate the emissions that are causing it, primarily of carbon dioxide, which means eventually eliminating dependence on fossil fuels. And despite the difficulties, we're moving, some countries are moving in that direction. Not all countries and not very fast. But progress has been made. The trouble is we emitted so much of this garbage already, and it's sitting up there in the atmosphere, that under even the most aggressive emissions reduction trajectories, there'll still be such an overload of it in the atmosphere in 30, 40, 50 years that we'll be having effects that we just don't want to have. We'll be going over into the climate danger zone, some of us refer to it as. So what do? You start to remove some of it from the atmosphere. Now, this is an emerging science, an emerging technology. It's not, at this point, the cost is rather high. That's why companies like the one you're talking about are in the business of trying to move from a demonstration project to commercialization. And we need more companies like that. We need more ideas about how to bring the price down. And maybe, just maybe, a few decades from now, it'll be a critical piece of a more comprehensive effort to get us away from fossil fuels and get the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
But Dr. Oppenheimer, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, this would be, if somebody came up with a very efficient way of doing this, they could make a fortune. It'd be worth
a fortune. They can only make a fortune if somebody's going to buy it. And somebody will only buy it if the governments put what's called a price on carbon. That is, if they make it expensive to have too much carbon around, then people will be willing to pay for someone or some technology to remove it from the atmosphere. If the governments make policies that say, we just can't let the earth warm beyond a certain point, then there'll be a value on getting it out of the atmosphere. But who's going to pay someone who does it today? It's not there. The system isn't set up for it. That's why it's a gamble.
Wow. Okay, so any idea what you would do with it if you collected this stuff? What do you do with it? How do you get rid of it?
Well, first of all, carbon dioxide, usually from underground carbon dioxide reservoirs that exist naturally, is used in enhanced oil recovery. You blow it into old oil wells, and out comes more oil that's worth more money than it costs to blow the carbon dioxide in. That's been going on for a long time. And so there are other minor uses of carbon dioxide, but that's potentially the biggest one. But eventually, look, there's so much of this stuff in the atmosphere. There is no clear useful purpose to it. It will have to be buried somewhere, probably underground. There is one idea for a new approach to making fuels, which is you take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that came from burning some fuel a long time ago. You turn it into a different fuel, and then you burn that fuel instead of digging up oil and coal and burning it. And that way you can approach what's called a carbon neutral situation. And therefore you will have removed carbon dioxide. You would have produced some energy. There's a net gain. The trouble with it is it's expensive to do that at this point, and it's not clear it'll ever be cheap enough so anybody would buy the stuff. So that's why this is very much in the experimental phase. The plant in Canada can do it because I think they can sell their carbon dioxide for a variety of uses. I'm not sure if enhanced oil recovery is in there. But if everybody's trying to do it, there's just too much carbon dioxide around. You have to find a new use for it, and that's where the fuel idea comes in. Personally, I'm skeptical of the fuel idea. I think what we're going to have to do is bury the stuff.
Well, how can you bury it? I mean, not only how can you bury it, but there's got to be some, you know, cause and effect from that. I mean, we can't just bury it and say it's going to go away.
Well, you know, in certain areas, there are what are called deep saline aquifers. These are places where there's salt water way underground. And the reason it stays there is because there's a layer of hard rock on top of it. So that if you can drill into that layer, in fact, the reason natural gas pockets are found underground is it's trapped below a solid layer, a cap rock, it's called, which keeps it from getting to the surface. The idea is you can drill into the cap rock, force the carbon dioxide down, seal the cap rock again, and it just stays there. There is some good evidence from the enhanced oil recovery industry that this actually works. It could be risky. It could escape. Carbon dioxide at high enough levels, if you're unlucky, can kill you. But it's promising. That's the current way of doing it that's promising. The trouble is expensive. To make it cheaper, you have to figure out somebody to sell it to. That's where the fuel idea comes in, but we don't know if that will ever be done cheaply enough. So that's why it's in the experimental phase.
I love the fuel idea. I got to be honest with you. That, if you know, if we're putting it to a vote, I say we spend whatever amount of money we need to spend and develop this new fuel. I mean, what a brilliant idea that would be. Taking the carbon dioxide out of our atmosphere and running our vehicles with it. Now, that's got to be the best.
Yeah. The only difficulty, I would say, I'm all in favor of governments and private entrepreneurs putting down money to investigate this. The only difficulty is I wouldn't want to say put all my money on one such idea. This is a complicated problem. We need a lot of approaches. Maybe somebody will find a way to make the burial thing cheaper. Maybe someone will develop this fuel idea. Maybe there's some unthought of idea which will come along. We need to be encouraging people to get out there and do the innovation.
And I don't want to get completely off topic, but what's your opinion of using electricity to, you know, drive our vehicles and power everything?
It's fine. In fact, it's a great thing if the electricity comes from clean fuel, i.e. renewable energy, solar or wind. If the electricity comes from coal, you're just making the current problem that much worse. Instead of just having the electric power industry as it is now, producing a lot of carbon dioxide, we'll have the electric power industry, plus worse, we'll have cars which are really, although they're running electricity, the electricity is made from coal in many cases, so they'll be run by coal, and that'll cause overall carbon dioxide emissions to shoot upward. So it's a good idea if it's timed with the displacement of coal by, say, solar energy or wind energy or hydro.
So in your opinion, that's really the only answer we have here. If we want to continue living on this planet, we've got to completely eliminate any use of any type of fossil fuel whatsoever.
Well, there's a little asterisk on that. In the short term, meaning 10, 20, 30 years, it could be that we will need some natural gas, which is emits less carbon dioxide by a factor of two than coal, but solar and wind aren't there all the time. And in an ideal system, you'd have these giant batteries which can store it, say, if it's a cloudy day. But you're going to need to fill in here and there with a little bit of fossil fuel burning. You can't get rid of all of it overnight, or you won't have enough electricity. But looking 50 or 60 years from now, yeah, I think we can look to a system that's run by solar, wind, a very efficient electricity transmission grid, and big storage capacity.
And that's really the key, isn't it? Storage capacity. Because I talked to buddies of mine
who've
got these solar panels out on their farms and stuff and all well and good. But they keep telling me the problem is I can't store it. I can't store big enough amounts and for long enough to be able to take advantage of it, right? And that's always been
absolutely
a problem.
Storage capacity is developing very quickly. The price is coming down. The battery, like big batteries, they're becoming cheaper and cheaper. I think that problem is going to be solved, not in 5 years, but the price will be reasonable in 10, 15 years. And then we really will be able to move toward a totally renewable system because we'll have a way to store the energy and even out the peaks when there's no wind, no sunlight.
Well, I'm not sure what the problem is there with the line, but Dr. Oppenheimer, we've definitely got a problem with our lines, and it's just terrible. Stephen, can we maybe get him back on at a later date or in the weeks to come? I don't know. I'll talk to John about that. That was Dr. Michael Oppenheimer, Department of Geosciences, Princeton University, Princeton, New Jersey. That's what it was. It was because it was crossing the border and had to get through the wall, the signal.
It's going to be huge. That cell phone signal's not going to go by.
Exactly. Exactly. I think Trump was listening in on it. I don't know. Anyways, thank you, doctor from Princeton. We will get you back on the air. Some fascinating things were said there. You know, I love the fact that battery storage is high on their radar, because I've always believed that. It's great to have all these alternative solar, you know, power this and alternate energy source. But if you can't store it, it's all for naught.
Exactly.
You know, for that matter, hydro is the same way. I mean, you know, water generated hydro is the same way. The problem is storing it. We can create it, but if we don't sell it off at the moment that we develop it, it goes for naught.
It's true.
Anyways, that was a fascinating discussion, and definitely would like to have him back on the show. But before we go away, I just want to remind folks, or not remind them, more or less congratulate the winners from the Canadian Tire Father's Day giveaway that we did. And congratulations to Sue Fletcher of St. Catharines, Ron Rizalski from Oakville, Dan Sutter, Georgetown, Kevin Frew from Barrie, and Danny O'Shea from Whitby were the winners of the $100 card from Canadian Tire Canada's Father's Day store. That are it, Stephen. We got to run. On behalf of the entire Outdoor Journal team, Stephen Labadie behind the glass, our producer Jonathan T. Winters, Derek Brandeo, and Jessica Ellis. I'm Angelo Viola. Have a great weekend, folks. Catch you next Saturday.